evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following program is sponsored by the Committees of One, the organization of which was suggested by the President of the United States in his famous Jackson Day dinner address early this year. Since then, the committees have expanded throughout the country, and now they have reached the surprising membership of 927,000 people. We bring you now an address by the President of the United States. Following his message to the people of the nation, the Democratic National Committee will present Senator Robert F. Wagner of New York, Mr. Edward A. Filene of Boston, and Chairman James A. Farley of the Democratic National Committee. Seated now in the quiet of his study in his home at Hyde Park, the President will deliver his Election Eve address, his final word to the people of the United States in his campaign for re-election. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, I have come home to my own county to vote with my fellow townsmen. My people have voted here in Dutchess County for more than a century, and I cast my first vote here in 1903. Tomorrow, 55 million Americans are eligible to vote, and I hope that all of those 55 million will vote. I like to think of these millions as individual citizens from Maine to the southern tip of California, from Key West to Puget Sound, farmers who stop their fall plowing long enough to drive into town with their wives, wage earners stopping on the way to work or the way home, business and professional men and women, town and city housewives, and that great company of youth for whom this year's first vote will be a great adventure. Americans have had to put up with a good many things in the course of our history, but the only rule we've ever put up with is the rule of the majority. That is the only rule we ever will put up with. Spelled with a small d, we are all of us Democrats. In some places in the world today, the tides are running against democracy. But our faith has not been unsettled. We believe in democracy because of our traditions, but we believe in it even more because of our experience. Here in the United States, we've been a long time at the business of self-government. The longer we are at it, the more certain we become that we can continue to govern ourselves, that progress is on the side of majority rule, that if mistakes are to be made, we prefer to make them ourselves and to do our own correcting. When you and I stand in line tomorrow for our turn at the polls, we will stand in a line that reaches back across the entire history of our nation. Washington stood in that line, and Jefferson, and Jackson, and Lincoln. And in later days, Cleveland stood there, and Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. All of these in their day waited their turn to vote. And rubbing elbows with them, their voting equals is a long succession of American citizens whose names are not known to history, but who by their vote helped to make history. Every man and woman who has voted in the past has had a hand in the making of the United States of the present. Every man and woman who votes tomorrow will have a hand in the making of the United States of the future. To refuse to vote is to say I am not interested in the United States of the future. We who live in a free America know that our democracy is not perfect, but we are beginning to know also that in self-government, as in many other things, progress comes from experience. People do not become good citizens by mandate. They become good citizens by the exercise of their citizenship and by the discussions, the reading, the campaign give and take, which help them to make up their minds how to exercise that citizenship. Not only are people voting in larger numbers this year, they also know more this year than ever before about the real issues. They are thinking for themselves. They listen to both sides. They no longer accept at face values, opinions, or even statements from newspapers, from political spokesmen, and from the so-called leaders of their communities. They insist on checking up. I doubt if there was ever more downright political intelligence at the average American fireside than there is today. For a century and a half, we have had here free education and a free press, free public forums, and a free pulpit. For more than a decade, we have had a free radio. The American citizen of 1936, therefore, is a product of free institutions. His mind has been sharpened by the exercise of freedom. That is why I have no fear, either of the threats of demagogues or the ambitions of dictators. Neither can get far or long thrive among a people who have learned to think for themselves and who have the courage to act as they think. This year, they have thought things through to a point where the eternal simplicities mean more than the fuzzbuzz of technical talk. They know that the important thing is the spirit in which government will face problems as they come up, and the values it will seek to preserve or to enhance. And at bottom, those are the things that count. Still another thing heartens me. This year, not only are more people voting, not only have people thought things through more carefully, but more people in all parties have assumed the obligation of citizens to get out and work in the political processes by which democracy maintains itself. Nearly 6 months ago, I said I make this specific recommendation, that each and every one of you who is interested in obtaining the facts and in spreading those facts abroad, each and every one of you interested in getting at the truth that lies somewhere behind the smoke screen of charges and countercharges of a national campaign, constitute yourself a committee of one. And hundreds of thousands have responded to that suggestion. Tonight, I salute those committees of one, not only with personal gratitude, but with the gratitude of a democracy that can only function if its people are willing to take honorable part in it. And I also commend those who have worked in a similar honorable way in the opposition. They too have helped the public to understand the issues before it, and that is a service to democracy too. I confidently look forward to their continued cooperation in the service of democracy. On Saturday night, I said that there should be no bitterness or hate where the sole thought is the welfare of the United States of America. That applies to men and women in all parties. It is true tonight on the eve of election, and it will be true after the election. Whoever is elected tomorrow will become the president of all the people. It will be his concern to meet the problems of all the people with an understanding mind and with no trace of partisan feeling. Any president should welcome any American citizen or group of citizens who can offer constructive suggestions for the management of government or for the improvement of laws. Society needs constant vigilance and the interest of individual men and women. And when you go to the ballot box tomorrow, do not be afraid to vote as you think best for the kind of a world you want to have. There need be no strings on any of us in the polling place. A man or woman in the polling booth is his or her own boss. There once was a time when the ballot was not secret, but that is not so today. How a citizen votes is the citizen's own business. No one will fire you because you vote contrary to his wishes or instructions. No one will know how you vote. And don't let anyone intimidate you or coerce you by telling you otherwise. In the polling booth, we are all equals. It is an experience in responsibility and humility to be permitted as president to know and share the hopes and the difficulties, the patience and the courage, the victories and the defeats of this great people. Sometimes men wonder overmuch what they will receive for what they are giving in the service of a democracy, whether it is worth the cost to share in that struggle, which is a part of the business of representative government. But the reward of that effort is to feel that they have been a part of great things, that they have helped to build, that they have had their share in the great battles of their generation. However large or small our part is, we can all feel with Theodore Roosevelt, who said many years ago, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, and spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither defeat nor victory."
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking from his home at Hyde Park, New York. We now introduce Mr. James Melton, who will sing "The Star-Spangled Banner."
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight? O'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, bombs bursting in air, gave
Democratic National Committee presents Senator Robert F. Wagner of New York, Mr. Edward A. Filene of Boston, and Chairman James A. Farley of the Democratic National Committee. Our first speaker will be Senator Wagner.
My friends, on the eve of this momentous election, I desire to convey a message to every American family with respect to a subject which concerns us all deeply and particularly affects the lives and happiness of the men and women who work for wages. In good and bad times alike, two fears dog the steps of every wage earner: the loss of pay by reason of unemployment, the loss of earning power by reason of old age. How shall I provide for my family when for any reason I lose my job? How shall I take care of myself and my wife when I am too old to work? These two questions cling to every waker like his shadow. They trouble his mind and disturb his sleep and envelop his life with a feeling of helpless insecurity from which every generation he has been yearning to escape. Obviously, this was a problem that no one workman could solve for himself. He was utterly helpless to deal with the nationwide tides of unemployment. And similarly, millions have tried and failed in their effort to make provisions for their old age and found themselves, after a lifetime of toil, holding out a tin cup and eating the bitter bread of charity. President Roosevelt's entry into the White House marked the beginning of our government's effort to meet and solve these great human problems. By August 1935, the Social Security law, which I sponsored, was signed by the president. On that happy day, the working people of the United States received a new Magna Carta, a new Bill of Rights, promising release from the fear of want in unemployment and old age. This was not a partisan victory. Both workers and employers cooperated in drafting the law. Both Democrats and Republicans united in passing the law by an overwhelming majority. And the whole country rejoiced in the law. That is, the whole country, with the exception of a small clique of die-hard labor exploiters who are opposed to security for our working people. Even this hard-bitten minority sensed the popular acclaim, and for 14 months after its enactment, during which time reasonable criticism could have been honestly and fairly debated, they remained silent. For 14 months, they lay low, awaiting a chance to strike a foul blow at the workers' security. They deliberately deferred their attack until the last moment of this campaign, in the hope that it would accomplish its evil end before there was time for the truth to prevail. I am referring, of course, to the deceitful little notices of supposed pay cuts that have been placed in millions of pay envelopes and repeated through circulars in all parts of our country. And this very afternoon, there appeared in a large chain of newspapers what purported to be a reproduction of an application blank issued by the Social Security Board. The board knew nothing about it. The board never has and never will ask for information about anyone's religion or personal life. This blank is a rank forgery. It is worthwhile to consider from what sources have been coming these forgeries and deceitful little notices, pretending to be concerned only with the welfare of the people who work for a living. Not a single one of these make-believe warnings has come from anyone who has ever been heard as a friend of the working man. They can all be traced to the Republican National Committee or to individuals and organizations notorious as hired spokesmen of the exploiter, the wage cutter, the sweatshop operator, the strike breaker, and the anti-labor employer. These are the same people who opposed relief, who opposed unemployment insurance, who opposed public works, who through their complete control of Mr. Hoover's administration kept any kind of action for the common people of America off the statute books, and who are now determined to wreck and demolish the whole structure of human welfare legislation that President Roosevelt has built. Let us look at their cunningly contrived little pay envelope messages. The first caption that we read is this: your pay is being reduced. That statement is conceived in malice and falsehood. The truth is that the Social Security law is increasing tremendously the compensation that the worker receives for his services, and I shall tell you how. First of all, let us take the old age insurance system. Under the Roosevelt Social Security Law, it is designed to spare the worker of today from the humiliation of charity in his old age and to assure him of dignified and substantial monthly insurance payments when he retires at the age of 65. This insurance system is an absolutely sound system backed by a fund in the United States Treasury. Into this fund, the worker pays regular premiums, just as he would pay premiums if he bought an old age insurance policy from a private insurance company. But there is this tremendous difference. For every dollar that the worker pays into this old age insurance fund, his employer is required to add another dollar, and both dollars belong to the worker. In addition, the whole cost of administering the system is paid for by the government. As a result, each worker gets a vested and certain right in an old age annuity that is 2.5 times as great as he pays for. It is his absolutely. And if he dies before reaching the age of 65, it will be paid to his family. The constant flow of money into the worker's insurance account to protect him when he grows old is his first pay increase under the Social Security law. Secondly, the law provides for unemployment insurance. That does not cost the worker a single penny. It is paid for entirely by the employer, and the money that the employer pays into a fund to care for the worker when he loses his job, that is the worker's second pay increase under the Social Security law. Now to sum up, in order that I may be perfectly clear, under both unemployment insurance and old age insurance, what does the worker contribute to his own fund? He pays a premium of $1 for every $100 of wages he obtains. What does the employer contribute? The employer pays $2 for every dollar the worker contributes. Who gets this money? Both the worker's dollar and the employer's $2 are paid to the worker in the form of unemployment insurance and old age insurance. Is that all that the worker gets? No. He gets the earnings on the old age pension fund. That, briefly, is why I say that the Social Security law means a pay increase to the age earners of America. So you see that the tears which the pay envelope propagandists are shedding for the worker are crocodile tears. What really bothers them is the fact that the worker gets more than 3.5 times as much as he contributes. What really upsets them is that industry is taxed to help lift the burden off the worker's shoulders. The vast majority of employers realize the benefits that come with this responsibility and wholeheartedly support this law. But the opponents of Social Security propose to relieve the employer of his share entirely by the complete destruction of old age insurance and unemployment insurance throughout the United States. Now, what is the second statement made by the fraudulent little pay envelope slips? They say that the funds for old age and unemployment insurance are not safe. They insinuate that the insurance fund will be stolen by the United States government. That is a brazen falsehood. The gentlemen behind these slips are well convinced of the honesty of the United States when they want to purchase tax-exempt securities for themselves. They are certain of the credit of the United States when they want to set up huge trust funds of government bonds so that neither their children nor their children's children will ever have to work. But when it comes down to the proposition of protecting the worker and the worker's children from starvation and destitution, then these gentlemen say that the United States is not to be trusted. This is the first time in American history that any responsible person has tried to besmirch the good faith of the American government. It is a last desperate maneuver of the Republican opposition that the American people will indignantly repudiate. Now, my friends, what has all this to do with the election tomorrow? It has a vital bearing upon the election. The very people who are proposing to wreck your Social Security are the backers and supporters of Mr. Landon. He is already tied hand and foot by the company he is keeping. No man yet ever entered the White House on the shoulders of the Bourbons without being prepared to do their bidding. Mr. Landon has not uttered a word of condemnation of the foul and fraudulent pay envelope campaign of the Republican National Committee. His own record as governor of Kansas and his own public statements in this campaign mark him as seeing eye to eye with these mouthpieces of reaction. Kansas never had an unemployment insurance law, never had an old age insurance law, and is one of the three states that never cooperated with the Social Security law to help the widowed, the orphaned, the crippled, and the blind. Mr. Landon, by his own confession, would repeal both national unemployment insurance and national old age insurance. He would retrace every step by which we have marched to Social Security, by which we have advanced from the agony and suffering of the Depression to the threshold of a new era of social justice and prosperity. As one who has given my whole life to the cause of Social Security, as one who knows what a hard and bitter fight must be fought to make even the slightest gains for the men and women who work for a living, I ask you not to let the progress which has been made under President Roosevelt slip from your grasp. I appeal to you to make the endorsement of President Roosevelt and of what he has accomplished so tremendous that no one will ever dare again to raise the ugly head of reaction to threaten your progress. That is the whole single issue in this campaign, progress against reaction. And I know you will decide that issue with a full sense of responsibility toward yourselves, your families, and the generations of Americans yet to come. Roosevelt must and shall be overwhelmingly reelected, because when Roosevelt wins, America wins. I thank you.
Our next speaker will be Mr. Edward A. Filene, who will speak to you from Boston.
Friends and fellow citizens of the United States of America, the emphasis, please, on united. At such a moment as this, one of the greatest turning points in American history, why in the world should you be listening to a Boston shopkeeper who in his whole life never held any political office, never ran for any political office, and never received and never asked and never will ask for any political favors? I know that if you are angry partisans on either side, you won't see any sense in anything that I shall say. But in spite of the heat and fury of this campaign, I am convinced that the great majority of us are not angry partisans on either side. In the main, I think we are friends and fellow citizens. That's the strangest thing about this whole campaign. The hottest, bitterest, maddest campaign within our memory has come at a time when the United States are more united than they ever were before, and when the people of the whole nation have become more conscious of their common interests. In former times, Easterners may have wanted one thing and Westerners another. Our employers have wanted one thing and employees another. But the New Deal and the terrible times which gave birth to the New Deal changed all that. We now see the business necessity for higher income to the masses. If the clothing and textile industries are depressed, or if farmers cannot sell their products profitably, it wouldn't help the situation any to increase my income, for the simple reason that my income is already large enough to enable me to buy all the clothes and all the farm products which I happen to want. But if we increase the incomes of the lower income groups, enabling them to buy all the clothes they want or all the farm-raised food which their children need, it would boom the clothing business, boom the textile industry, boom American agriculture, and boom all work-giving production as these have never boomed before. And we voters are practically unanimous in wanting such things to happen. If the Republican Party were to come out definitely against higher incomes for the masses, not one Republican voter out of 10 would vote the Republican ticket. Until March 1933, however, neither party had ever worked out any plan for achieving business recovery by increasing the buying power of the people generally. Neither party, in fact, had any idea that any such plan could be evolved. That is the great meaning of these great new times. Heretofore, we assumed, whether we were Republicans or Democrats, that if we increased the income of one group, it was necessarily at the expense of some other group. But that isn't true any longer. I'll say that these are new times. But new times demand a new deal. Further, when we come to new times, we come to them with thinking shaped by the old times. In the beginning, then, new times are times of widespread confusion. And to launch a program applicable to the new times requires not merely vision and understanding, but leadership of the first magnitude, leadership which cannot be swayed in its definite purposes by the buffeting cross currents of special interests and of old deal thinking. None of us, of course, think the New Deal perfect, nor has it been completed. But what we want to know is this. First, is it in accordance with these new times? That is, has it aimed definitely to increase the buying power of the American people generally? Second, has it worked? Has it helped to bring us from depression to prosperity? Third, do we want the various innovations which have gone to make up President Roosevelt's New Deal? Do we, for instance, want unemployment insurance? Undoubtedly we do, although it was a political innovation which could never have been enacted in Congress except for the strong leadership of President Roosevelt. Unemployment insurance was not a program in itself. It was a vital part of the New Deal which had become necessary, as necessary to business as it was to the unemployed. For unemployment insurance means assurance of employment. The thing that makes unemployment spread like a plague is that the unemployed cannot buy. By enabling them to buy, however, even though unemployed, they will keep up such a demand for goods as to maintain employment. What the workers will get from unemployment insurance then is not merely the amount which they put into it, nor the amount which the employers are compelled by law to add to this. What they will get will be more regular employment, more wages, many times more money than the whole sum they contribute. Next, do we want old age insurance? Undoubtedly we do, and for the same reason. It isn't merely a humanitarian issue. It is part of the New Deal in these new times. Old age insurance has now become necessary to business, to labor, and to successful farming. If the old can't buy enough to live well, businessman can't sell enough to do well, which means that masses of those who are young and strong and able to work cannot be employed. For the same reasons, the vast majority of the American voters also want other things which the New Deal has given us, namely government cooperation with farmers, protection of bank deposits up to $5,000, and adequate relief for all the victims of our traditional Old Deal way of doing business when, because we became able to produce so much, that traditional way had brought us to the worst depression in our whole history. Upsetting tradition, however, is a pretty serious thing, and it must be admitted that powerful interests wedded to tradition do not want the American people to have all these things. And it is interesting to note that these interests are unanimously backing Governor Landon for the presidency, although Governor Landon himself seems to favor most of these New Deal measures, and I believe is quite sincere in his position. Can anyone guess why this is? These interests met, we must remember, only a year ago in a convention of the National Manufacturers Association and drew up a platform denouncing all of these things which the New Deal has brought us, even denouncing Social Security and calling for a return to rugged individualism, which means each man for himself and the devil take the masses who are not employers and therefore do not and cannot control employment. And yet today, although they have not changed their minds, these old dealers are unanimously backing Landon. There's a reason. To favor a New Deal is one thing. To put it over in a time of national confusion is another. Roosevelt put it over. Landon promises that he will do the same thing and do them much better. But he also promises that there will be no must legislation. In other words, he promises bounties for farmers, but promises that he won't insist upon them. He favors Social Security, including unemployment insurance and old wage insurance, but he won't use his power as president to push such measures through. That lets him out. That suits the special interest exactly. If their candidate stood on their platform, he couldn't get many votes anyway. So they don't care what Landon favors if he will only keep his one sacred promise and not insist, as President Roosevelt has insisted, that the New Deal must go through, that we must as a nation go forward until the masses of the American people are secure in their right to work, in their right to buy, and their right in this age of abundance to buy abundantly. Can we not see then why this campaign has not been a campaign of discussion of New Deal principles or of New Deal measures, but a campaign of bitterness and hatred on the part of traditional Old Deal minds and on the part of interests it would be well to remember who own and control many of our larger newspapers? Why has the president been denounced as a dictator, although on the very face of it, if there were a dictatorship, no administrative measures could have been annulled by the Supreme Court and no such political opposition would be permitted? Why has the opposition shrieked about the Constitution versus the New Deal? They know that we reverence the Constitution, Republicans and Democrats alike, but we reverence it because it was a New Deal at a crisis in our national life when new times had made a new deal necessary. Why all this hysteria about departing from the American way of life when the American way of life is and always has been a way of rapid change? And why all this cry about the cost of the New Deal when, by increasing our national net debt by $6.5 billion, we've already increased our national income by $20 billion in a single year? There's just one reason: traditional thinking, not real business thinking. We businessmen wanted recovery, and we got it. But we lost something which I have always thought we should lose. We lost control of America. We're doing much better in a business way than we did 4 years ago. But if the New Deal is completed and all Americans are guaranteed the right to work and to buy abundantly, we businessmen cannot be their bosses any longer. To succeed under the New Deal, we must become their servants. We must live up to the old command: let him that would be great among you be the servant of all. Now, we need not get angry because some business leaders are not yet ready to accept such a great change as this. All we need to do when we vote tomorrow is to say whether we are ready for it. Do we want business to become our servant, or do we want it to become our master once more? That is why, on the eve of perhaps the most momentous election in our history, I haven't said a word about party politics. 9 out of 10 of us, at least, want what the New Deal under President Roosevelt's great leadership has brought us. And if we haven't lost our heads, as the special interests have hoped we would by now, 9 out of 10 of us will vote for President Roosevelt's re-election, not as Republicans and Democrats, but as friends and fellow citizens of one United States. Thank you very much.
We now present our next speaker, the Honorable James A. Farley, Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who will bring you the closing message of the 1936 campaign. Mr. Farley.
The story has been told. I believe everybody in America has made up his mind how he will vote tomorrow. 4 years ago, on a parallel occasion, I told the people that Franklin D. Roosevelt and John N. Garner would be overwhelmingly elected President and Vice President of the United States. I was not speaking then at random, but from a definite conception of the spirit of this country. Tonight, let me tell you in all sincerity that I am just as sure of what tomorrow's election will bring forth as I was 4 years ago. Our country will reaffirm their confidence in our great leaders even more emphatically than was the case in 1932. I spoke of them then as leaders of the Democratic Party. Now I speak of them as leaders of the nation, regardless of party. They are the champions of all who look forward to greater prosperity and wider happiness for our country. There has been and is no doubt in my mind as to the outcome of the election. It has been apparent throughout the campaign that people not only approved what has been done by the Roosevelt administration, but are determined that the policies of the president shall be carried on for 4 more years. This conviction on the part of the electorate, I know to be nationwide. It is a response of the national character of the things that President Roosevelt has accomplished. His aims and ideals have concerned the future happiness of 125 million people. And in the hearts of a vast majority, his deeds are imperishably recorded. Never in my experience have I seen such cooperation, such sympathy, and such devotion as has been manifested by the organization folks who have contributed so much to the success of this campaign. I want to express my sincere thanks and gratitude to those who have worked in harness with me every hour of every day since the convention at Philadelphia sent us off to a glorious start. My special regards are extended to every member, man and woman, of the Democratic National Committee. Their burden in every state has been a heavy one. They have served so faithfully and so ably that there is not a corner in the land tonight where I feel that anything has been left undone that needed doing. State chairman and vice chairman, state directors, have been no less active and useful. The thousands of county chairmen and women have even more unusually performed the sort of effective service that wins elections. I cannot and must not stop there. The enthusiastic cooperation which has been extended me has reached on down to the district and precinct workers, where thousands of party Trojans have been at work for the past 4 months, doing the sort of routine but necessary things that spells organization, and organization spells success. Our speakers were on the road for months, forgetful of weather and personal discomfort, carrying the message of Roseville democracy to all who would listen. Our organization at national headquarters worked with tireless energy and clock-like precision. Colored people and the voters of foreign extraction gave us perfect cooperation and unwavering loyalty. They worked like the zeal that is born of conviction and deep political faith. To all those folks I have just mentioned, let me extend now the grateful and hearty thanks of the Democratic National Committee, myself as chairman, and of President Roosevelt personally. You've been patriotic soldiers in a conquering army. The triumph of the principle for which you have fought in this election will be a source of pride and satisfaction through you throughout your lifetime. And I wish to add a brief word of praise for the election officials of both parties who will work from dawn tomorrow until the votes are counted. None of these loyal soldiers in the great army of democratic workers will ever get credit enough for what have been done. It would be impossible for anyone to reward or praise them sufficiently. I want them to know that I appreciate beyond any possible measure in words their loyalty and devotion. They have made it possible for me to say with all of the assurance and conviction at my command that through them, a great victory has been won. We need not only to confirm that victory. There is one more task for all of us. This responsibility lies more heavily on the humble party workers than those who have played directing parts so far. We must all of us get out the vote and see that no opportunity is overlooked to get every supporter of the president to cast his vote tomorrow. I have been a precinct worker myself for a quarter of a century. I know that there is a job to be done on election day, that it is hard and unexciting, but I also know that it is tremendously important. This has been a hard-fought campaign. It has closed with shrill cries of hate and bitterness from our opponents. They have, in desperation, said and done things which lacked foundation either in form or substance. I regret that they were unable to restrain the wails of the loser. The last-minute misrepresentations only do them harm, and the country as a whole no good. It means that a little more time will have to pass before the scars heal up. We once more achieve that unity of purpose which has made us a great nation. What, for instance, has been accomplished by the deliberate effort which has been made to mislead the workers of the United States with respect to the Social Security Act? Its enactment will be written in the pages of history as one of the greatest accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration. It means that in the future, the working men and women of the country may labor without doubt and fear of what may be their fate in old age. It is insurance against the poorhouse or the charity of our neighbors when we have reached the limit of usefulness. The contributions which workers and employers make share and share alike are not a tax, but insurance premium, which provides benefits at rates below any that private companies could afford to make. Perhaps more important of all is the fact, generally overlooked, the Social Security Act provides for unemployment insurance without any cost at all to the working man. It is a federal pledge that the people will never again be compelled to suffer as they did during the recent Republican Depression. I sincerely and honestly believe that those who have been responsible for attempting to destroy the faith of the people and what they believe to be a means of protection against want and misery in their declining years have much to answer, not only to those to whom they have tried to mislead, but to their own consciousness as well. Every American who favors social security as a substitute for the dole and other forms of emergency relief must regret the injection of this issue into the campaign in a warped way in which it has been presented. The sweeping victory which President Roosevelt will win tomorrow at the polls will be due in substantial measure to the loyalty and devotion of the working people of America and of the women of America. To my mind, it is extremely significant. These two great groups of people are overwhelmingly in favor of the president's re-election because they suffered most from the ravages of the Depression. They know the agony and heartaches of financial insecurity, misery, and want. They know who was their friend and protector in the Great Depression, brought on by Republican neglect and incompetence. In expressing this sincere and grateful appreciation to every unit in our victorious armory, I would be extremely remiss if I overlooked the businessmen, big and little, who supported our cause with such undivided loyalty. They helped us financially in a most substantial manner. These men have performed a lasting service both to their profession and their country. They have been alive and alert in sustaining every move of the Roosevelt administration to sponsor human betterment and to relieve human want. I commend these businessmen especially because they have stood for their convictions against the noisy and at times unfair partisan attacks of a small minority in the industrial world. To my mind, one of the most heartening things during the past few years was the fidelity of millions of unemployed men and women to the cherished institutions of America. It is pleasant to recall they maintained their faith in democratic institutions while members of the Liberty League were whining for a dictatorship. Let me say before closing that the Democratic Party is deeply grateful to those millions of progressive Republicans who made victory possible in 1932 by voting for the election of our candidate, Mr. Roosevelt. We know that you have not been disappointed. Chief Executive has kept faith with you and faith with the country by sponsoring one of the greatest relief and human welfare programs in all our history. We welcome the support of these millions of progressive Republicans once again. We rejoice, in fact, that no one has dared question the patriotism of this great band of stalwart liberals who have placed principle above party by uniting in support of President Roosevelt. Let me assure these progressives once again that they will not be disappointed, that they will not be betrayed. The next 4 years will find President Roosevelt adhering as he has in the past to the great humanitarian principles which always guide his conduct in public office. I wish to say a word of thanks to those great newspapers which have supported us in this campaign, and also to those newspapers which, even though they failed to support us editorially, gave the Democratic cause an even break in their news columns. That is all we asked, an even break. To the radio people also, I extend the sincere thanks of the Democratic National Committee. We have had splendid and continuous cooperation from those who manage the broadcasting facilities of America. The fact that President Roosevelt personally has been able to bring his message into nearly every home by his own voice has been a tremendous factor in this campaign. The campaign is now at an end. We are grateful to the millions who have listened faithfully to the barrage of political oratory over the airways, especially during the past couple of weeks. No doubt it will be a relief to you to turn off the switch with the realization that you have heard your last political speech. All that can be said has been said. The decision is in your hands. The 0 hour is approaching. Within a short time, the polls will be open. Within a few hours, the greatest popular referendum in history will be underway. Within a few hours, millions upon millions of free Americans will enter the voting booth to select the man whom they believe best fitted to administer the affairs of this great nation for the next 4 years. There is no other issue. The Democratic Party is proud of its candidates and their records. In little over 3 years, the President of the United States has rebuilt the nation's economic timbers and restored the nation's courage and confidence. He has led us in the pathway of peace, progress, and prosperity to a position of world leadership never surpassed in American history. The United States is a great country, and in every crisis, a great leader has come forth. These great names are written in the letters of gold upon the pages of American history. In the last couple of years, another name has been added to the list of imperishable Americans. Tomorrow, more than 25 million of his fellow citizens will give a vote of confidence and thanks to the stalwart leadership who has brought us safely through the great crisis, to the gallant leader who has kept faith with America, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Thank you very much, and good night.
You have been listening to a program sponsored by the Democratic National Committee, during which President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Honorable James A. Farley, Senator Robert Wagner, and Mr. Edward Filene have spoken. The National Broadcasting Company wishes to thank the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, the Horlicks Malted Milk Company, the Pepsodent Company, and Miles Laboratories, makers of Alka-Seltzer, for relinquishing their broadcast periods this evening in order that we could bring you the program just concluded. Their programs will be back on the air next Monday at the usual time. We also wish to thank the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey for delaying the start of their program over some of these stations.
Ladies and gentlemen, we realize that for most of us, the words foreign affairs mean really very little. Europe is a part of the world which we may have visited or not. But Europe, as Hendrik Van Loon has been pointing out to us, is very much aware of our existence. For we have something which most European countries no longer enjoy: unlimited credit and most of the gold in the world. Therefore, he fears that serious efforts will continue to be made to get us involved in some European entanglement, so that we may be obliged to open our pocketbooks and open them wide. It is against this danger that he has been trying to warn us. This warning, of course, is his own personal view of the situation, and he gives you his own opinions. But in so doing, he tells you what is in the mind of someone who has lived in most European countries, who understands the language of a great many of them, and who therefore may be supposed to know something about what we might call the psychological inside. Ladies and gentlemen, Hendrik Willem Van Loon.
As a nation, we have a great capacity for being startled and upset by the revelations that are, with a fair degree of regularity, being made to us by our newspapers. Here for years we had thought we were living peacefully in a peaceful and law-abiding country. And then suddenly it appears that none of us could drink a glass of milk or eat an onion without first of all having paid tribute to some milk racketeer or some onion racketeer, and that one couldn't order a dish of ham and eggs without quietly slipping a couple of pennies into the pocket of some retired waiter who was now offering protection to his former employer and was insisting upon offering that protection by means of bombs and other unpleasant means of giving expression to his disapproval. Now, there really is nothing very new about all this, a sentence I have so often repeated in these little sermons. Nothing very new. You can follow the racketeer all through history, for he made his unwelcome appearance the moment our cities had grown so big that he could hope to operate without very much danger of ever being found out. Of course, he didn't always call himself a benefactor of society, and he did not always offer to defend those who paid him their tribute against their imaginary enemies. But under one form or another, he has been with us for quite a long time. And we really needn't look so surprised if tomorrow we should discover that even the trees in our parks have to pay an annual subscription to be allowed to grow at all, and that the squirrels, too, must probably contribute a few of their peanuts to some mysterious official collector of the Squirrel Protective Association. But tonight I'd like to go just a little further. I was going to speak, at least I'd planned to speak, upon some other very valuable services which Monsieur Alexis de Tocqueville, whom I mentioned last Sunday, had rendered us before his untimely death. And then looking that up, I came upon the dispute that he had had in the middle of the last century with one of the pure race fanatics of his days, for these two have been visitors since the beginning of time. And then I found that I didn't know enough and I got into unexplored territory, and I shall need at least 4 or 5 more days in the library to get hold of a few more necessary facts. And meantime, I thought that I might pay my respects to one of the oldest of racketeers, a racketeer who can trace his ancestry all the way back to the days of the cavemen. I refer to the international racketeer, who is merely a better class of highwayman, who threatens to kill you unless you pay him for the express purpose of his not killing you. Now, sometimes this gentleman has been rather crude in his method of operation. There was the old-fashioned pirate, or rather, there were the old-fashioned pirates, whose activities covered most of the Mediterranean and the Aegean Sea. They used to establish in the days of Caesar mutually protective organizations, which you could thereupon either join or not as you saw fit, but which you had better join unless you were willing to cross the river Styx at a very unexpected moment, swinging from one of the yard arms of one of your own vessels. Now, the sea has always offered great opportunities to the professional racketeer. And many of these, like the famous Vikings, did exceedingly well for themselves, and they made quite a reputation in history, but as national heroes rather than highwaymen. Indeed, they would have resented that name very greatly. But you know how it is with those things. As a nation on the whole, we still have considerable respect for what Sam Weller used to call the aristocracy. Now, aristocracy, of course, is nothing but old money. Give us another 5 or 6 generations without too many disturbing elements in Washington, and we shall probably have a very nice aristocracy of our own, very much after the European pattern. And perhaps in another 500 or 600 years, we shall have a nice House of Lords of our own. But if any of the members of that House of Lords of ours in the year 2437 are as outspoken as their medieval predecessors have been, they would show a blackjack rampant suspended over a private citizen couchant on the coat of arms engraved upon their private stationery, for that's all they are. If there should be among those who are listening some ambitious young man or woman looking for a nice subject that would allow them to write an historical study that would really make a stir, I suggest the history of racketeering throughout the ages. I wish that I'd thought of it years ago. It's too late for me now. I don't mean physically, for I fully intend to continue my historical doubts, which is the same as my studies, for at least another 30 years. What keeps me from doing it is not a historical doubt, but a physical certainty. I would have to make some first-hand researches in certain archives in certain countries, and I have very little taste for life in a concentration camp. But others whose opinions are less widely known than some of mine, perhaps, they would run no such risks, and what a magnificent subject. The history of racketeering throughout all the ages. For all those picturesque robber barons of the Middle Ages were nothing but racketeers. Look for their castles, and you'll find them where? You'll find them on some convenient rock that dominates the trade route through some alpine valley. And being safely hidden behind the high walls of his castle, the noble baron could thereupon say to every passing peddler, "Give me, please, 30% of the value of everything you have in that cart, or your family will never see you again, and that would be a pity." And the castle didn't always have to be on a mountain road either, by no means. Not so far away from the spot where the English during the Great War tried to force the Dardanelles, There stands a low castle on top of a hill. There stood some 3,000 years ago a town that had gained great renown because one of its bright young men stole himself the lovely wife of a Greek king who lived on the other side of the Aegean. Of course, you know the story. Paris and Helen and the eyes that set a thousand ships sailing across the Aegean Sea. I know the original is the face, but I need the eyes. For those eyes may well have been very lovely, but even the loveliest of eyes, although on occasion they may, by one single glance, blow a mighty monarch off his throne, those eyes will hardly ever cause the mobilization of an entire navy. There was, of course, another cause, a much more prosaic one. But Homer was not born in Missouri. Homer hailed from Hollywood. And he realized that he would have to idealize the situation if he wanted to be a bestseller for 30 centuries. Yet it was a wonderful story, but it had very little to do with the anger of an old Greek king because a bright young man from Troy, Asia, had stolen his wife. The truth is that Troy was merely a racketeering city. It was situated on the main route from Asia to Europe, and everybody had to pay the Troy protective organization of old man Priam and his hefty son Hector so much tribute for the privilege of crossing from Asia into Europe, or he would never reach his destination at all. Yes, my good friends, racketeering is as old as the mountains of Vermont and has played just as interesting a role in history because it was never quite called by the name it deserved, but it was invariably idealized as a civic or national necessity. It was associated with patriotism. It was interwoven with the deeds of mighty emperors and kings, and even now, if I should point to some of the extra revenue that may have been obtained by a certain King Solomon, who was in command of a certain fortress that dominated the trade route from Egypt to Babylonia, and that was called Jerusalem, if I were rash enough to say this, but I'm not, we would have the male sex of this respectable establishment here in Radio City so full of protests that our record of 6 million letters a year, and you heard correctly the first time, 6 million letters a year, why, if I were to say such a thing or hint at it, our supply of our mail would be doubled overnight. Now, of course, in our modern day and age, we do things differently. We are not as brutal in our practices as we used to be. We have learned at least one new trick. The trick of sitting down on something that is somebody else's property and then saying very prettily, now you will either pay me to leave your property or I'll stay right here until I get paid. Now nations can't always do that, but they can suggest where they intend to sit down, figuratively speaking, and where they intend to remain sitting, again figuratively speaking, until they shall have been paid a little bribe to go away and leave the rightful owners in possession of their rightful property. And that is one of the perils which threaten us, or rather which would threaten us if it didn't happen that the government at Washington at this moment has a fairly realistic conception about such sort of hijacking and has therefore most carefully avoided being forced into a position where even indirectly we might have been suspected of contributing one single penny of hush money to a cause that is none of our business and never can be. As I've often said before, the ways of Europe are not our ways, and for our own good they never should be. If the nations that are faced by the threat of an armed dictatorship are now willing to pay their neighbors, who are deliberately holding them up by their threat of making a nuisance of themselves, if they are willing to pay them for being a nuisance and going away rather than fight it out, that's their business. But we have just escaped a very dangerous precedent, and we have escaped it successfully because this time we realized what was being done. We realized that we were being asked to make certain loans that in turn would be used to bribe other powers for making war. Every penny we give to Europe, of course, increases the danger to our own safety, for we know only too well that the money will be used not to feed the children, but merely to build more battleships and to buy more flying machines and to equip more soldiers. And why in the name of common sense should anybody give money to a neighbor with a hard luck story when he knows perfectly well that his neighbor will use that money to buy himself a nice pistol with which to rob him tomorrow? Him, the man who has befriended him, and steal his purse. Well, we escaped this peril, and small credit to those financial agencies that would have taken their commissions on the loan just as unconcernedly as they did during all the years immediately after the war, and who would have arranged for some more millions to be sunk into the bottomless pit of European armaments, knowing full well that not a cent of those investments would ever be paid back to our citizens, who now count their losses on that sort of loans by the hundreds of millions. I have no doubt that the attempt will be renewed and revived, and will be revived very soon. The international racketeer is the most persistent and the most persuasive of all the many enemies of society. He will starve his own people because the money to feed him must be used for cannon and guns, and he will then appeal with tears in his voice to our well-known generosity, our great big American heart, and ask our Red Cross to feed his poor, dear, starving multitudes. Or he will discover some roundabout way to get at our hearts and purse strings, especially the purse strings, and if possible, he'll work very quietly, and he will work through a middleman. But this is the warning I would like to give you, middleman or straight appeal. There is only one answer for us. We should establish right here and now a financial Monroe Doctrine. A financial Monroe Doctrine, which shall go back to a well-known and very successful pre-revolutionary doctrine. And that doctrine was as follows, slightly modified for modern needs. Billions for legitimate purposes, but not 1 cent for racketeering, either domestic or international.
Hendrik Willem van Loon, noted historian and author, has given us more of his personal views on foreign affairs. Network of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City.